From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, two views on Donald Trump's Detroit outreach to black voters.
He is saying to the voters, I am going to be an advocate for you. I'm going to be a change agent in Washington.
He refers to us as, quote unquote, the blacks, like we're just this thing that can be tossed around like a rubber ball.
A housing emergency in Lansing is the owner of a hotel evicts nearly 100 low-income residents.
I think this is his way of getting rid of the homeless angels and all the homeless individuals that are there.
A new rule for students at One Battle Creek High School. No cell phones in classrooms ever.
The constant distraction is numbing.
And we'll talk about the special way one car dealership reaches out to hearing impaired and deaf customers. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Donald Trump comes to Detroit this Saturday, hoping to appeal to African-American voters. He'll visit a congregation at Great Faith Ministries, although word is he will not speak then. Then he'll sit down to tape a TV interview with Bishop Wayne T. Jackson, which will then be broadcast on Jackson's Impact Television Network. This latest visit to Michigan comes right on the heels of the summer nominating convention held last weekend by Michigan's Republican Party. And with us now is the chairman of the Michigan GOP, Ronna Romney McDaniel. Welcome back to Stateside.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, this marks Mr. Trump's third visit to Michigan within a month. What do you hear him saying to people in Michigan?
Well, he's saying, I'm showing up for you. I'm here to fight for your votes. I'm here to take my case to Michiganders, and I'm going to be here for you for the long haul. I'm not just going to show up for an election and then abandon you once I get elected. And I think we haven't had that in a long time in our state.
Why do you believe that Donald Trump is the right choice for president? And I don't want to start with talking about why Hillary Clinton is the wrong choice, but why is Donald Trump right?
Sure. I think the thing that Donald Trump brings to this this election that we haven't seen before is he is saying to the voters, I am going to be an advocate for you. I'm going to be a change agent in Washington. We have sent politician after politician to Washington, D.C., and they have not tackled the issues that they campaign that they're going to tackle, immigration reform, tax code reform, entitlement reform. We know that our entitlements are running out, our deficit, our debt. And he is saying, I'm going to go and actually fix the things I'm campaigning for. And you can believe me because I'm not a Washington insider. I'm a businessman. I'm different. And give me a chance to show you that I will tackle the issues that I campaign on.
Then what do you make of the well over 100 Republican leaders? We've got current and former members of Congress, high-level officials from Republican administrations, governors, highly respected, experienced Republicans who have said openly they will not vote for Mr. Trump, and some even say they're going to vote for Hillary Clinton. And, of course, last weekend at the convention, Governor Snyder stayed on the sidelines, no endorsement from him. What are these folks missing that you're seeing?
Well, he is running for the average voter, for the middle-class American and Michigander who has found themselves working 2 to 3 jobs, who are making less than they were making 10 years ago, people who are being left behind, who have not had an advocate in Washington. They can't afford lobbyists. They're not part of the elite class. They don't have those connections. And Trump is saying, I'm going to go and I'm going to be your advocate. And, of course, we don't have everybody in our party there. We want them all there. But a lot of the people who aren't supporting him are part of the elite class. They are part of the established class, and they do have those connections. He's not running for them. He's running for the average voter, the average Michigander, who cannot seem to get ahead under the Obama anemic recovery.
What do you say to people who are feeling like they can't get ahead, but they feel it's Republican policies that are the reason why?
Well, I think you can look at the record under the Obama administration. Our poverty rates are higher. Home ownership is down. We are leaving many, many Americans behind in this anemic recovery, and people just are not getting ahead, and the proof is in the numbers. I mean, you go look at the poverty rates. You look in Detroit. You look at the dropout rates. You look at all the things that are happening across the country. It is just not where it needs to be. In fact, this is one of the worst recoveries from recession we've ever seen in the history of our country.
Yet we see more people with, you know, who have medical insurance. We've seen unemployment rates cut. In fact, I want to kind of pivot over to the view that Mr. Trump is very clear about with Michigan, very dark and you know, manufacturing and the state of the auto industry in Detroit, a very dark view. But then you look at Governor Snyder, who's worked very hard to push that comeback story. And indeed, Michigan manufacturers are back adding jobs. We're up to more than 600,000 manufacturing jobs, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So Governor Snyder has a very contrasting view. Who's right here?
Well, I think Governor Snyder in Michigan has bucked the national trend. I mean, nationally, you're seeing more people leaving the labor workforce. You've seen a lot of states suffering. Michigan has defied what's happening nationally. Our unemployment is significantly lower. We are attracting jobs. We've added 475,000 new jobs. And I think when you look at Michigan, it's a perfect example of what Donald Trump can bring. Jennifer Granholm is Hillary Clinton light. What Jennifer Granholm did to our state, her policies drove us into the ditch. We lost jobs. Our unemployment was skyrocketing. And it's taken Republican leadership and policies to turn our state around. And those same policies in the White House are going to help the rest of the country at the same level that Michigan has been helped under Republican leadership.
We're speaking with the chairman of the Michigan Republican Party, Ronna Romney McDaniel. And as we speak, Mr. Trump meeting with Mexico's president today, and then later he's expected to make a major policy speech on immigration, which really has been one of his core issues. It does seem in the past week he's kind of backtracked some, or at least showing some flexibility and movement on his hardline stance of the wall, no amnesty, no pass to citizenship. What are you personally hoping to hear from him today with this big speech he's going to be giving on immigration?
Well, I'm excited to hear him talk about an immigration policy that will be put in place under his administration. Certainly, we saw President Obama put this as a center point in his campaign for president and has not tackled it. And I think that has exacerbated the problems in this country. We absolutely need some type of immigration reform. It's something that a lot of candidates bring up often on the campaign trail. And again, Mr. Trump is saying, I'm actually going to execute this when I'm in office. I'm actually going to get these things done. I don't know what he's going to say. I am going to be tuning in, but I'm very excited that, again, he is tackling substantive issues during this race.
We should point out no president can tackle anything without the support of Congress, and Mr. Obama really hasn't had that.
Well, he did have the first 2 years with a Senate and a House, and he didn't tackle it then. So he did have the first 2 years of his presidency with complete Democrat control, and he chose not to tackle that issue during that time.
The political conversation in this country around immigration tends to focus on the people crossing American borders illegally. But one of the big reasons they're doing that and coming here is because American employers are giving them jobs. The agricultural and service industries immediately come to mind. Why is there not more talk in the GOP platform about focusing on the role of American employers?
I think there is discussion about that. I think everything's on the table. And Mr. Trump will address that tomorrow. But I think the main focus is that Obama policies are not helping our country. They're not helping with immigration. Again, when you brought up health care, we just saw Aetna pull out of the health care exchange. That's not working. We need a real change agent in Washington, and Donald Trump is tackling all the issues that many Americans have not seen being addressed in our Washington leadership.
Well, let's go back to what you're hearing is amongst GOP circles when you're saying ideas are being talked about. What ideas in particular about, again, focusing on the employer's role in this?
Well, you've seen verification talked about in terms of employers with immigration. I'm not familiar with all the specific policy ideas Donald Trump's going to put forward, so I'd like to see his plan tomorrow. But certainly that's something that's been at the forefront of all the discussions with Republicans and Democrats in this election.
Because, you know, certainly this is being watched carefully in Michigan. Agricultural business relies so heavily on these workers who are coming. You know, it matters very much to a lot of people in Michigan where the answer is going to lie.
Well, I think a lot of people are saying we'd like to see legal immigration. We want people to come here legally. There is a form of legal immigration, obviously. I have family members that have legally immigrated to this country. All of us have. And so we need to find a way to make that continue, but also to not let illegal immigrants jump ahead of the line of those people who have come here legally seeking employment.
Lastly, this past weekend at the convention, the Michigan GOP convention, you and your colleagues gave William Rawerdink a vote in the Electoral College should Mr. Trump win Michigan. 10 years ago, he was serving almost 4 years in prison in order to pay more than $250 million in fines in what's been called one of the worst accounting fraud scandals ever. Why is he now a leader in Michigan's GOP?
Well, first of all, our electoral candidates are determined by congressional district, so that was not done at the entire convention. That was done in the 14th congressional district. We've seen a lot of people make mistakes in their lives and come back and run for office, and that's part of our process in this country. You serve your time and you're able to come back. We've seen that on the Democrat side over and over again. So you can ask the 14th district chair and those people in that caucus why they chose him to elect their district, but as far as the state party, he was not elected at the full convention.
What, in your view, would get someone disqualified from a key leadership role? If not that, what would?
Anything that would prevent somebody from actually being able to vote. He's permitted to vote in this country, in the state. If we had a law that would say you're not able to vote because of actions that you have done, then I think that would be a disqualifying factor as anybody serving as an elector.
And certainly back to Mr. Trump's visit Saturday, what role will you have in that? How much interaction with him will you have?
Well, we're thrilled to see him come to Detroit. The Republican Party of Michigan has had an office in Detroit for well over 2 years, and we're competing for votes and recognizing that we have work to do to reach out to communities that have not traditionally voted Republican. And let's talk about things like school choice and criminal justice reform, areas where Republicans are leading, and we're fighting for votes that haven't traditionally gone our way, and that's what we should be doing. We should be reaching out to everybody to take our message to every American. And you know what? Every American is better served when both parties are fighting for their votes. This is a great part of democracy.
Ronna Romney McDaniel, the chairman of the Michigan GOP. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside, Ronna.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Put the cell phone away, not in your pocket, not in your purse or backpack. Park it in your locker and keep it out of your classroom. That's the new rule for students who are returning to class at Lakeview High School in Battle Creek. Principal Jeff Bohl is with us now. Jeff, spell out exactly what Lakeview students may or may not do with their cell phones from here on.
Well, in the past, we have had a cell phone policy that allowed teachers classroom by classroom to set their own policy. And for this coming school year, the staff, this is a decision made by the whole staff, has decided that we are going to not allow cell phones and other smart devices or small electronic devices in the classroom at all. Students are to keep them in their locker. If we see them in the classroom or hear them, then they'll be confiscated. The first couple times, students will be able to pick them up, and after that, parents will need to pick them up, and detentions accrue and increase over time.
All right. So why did you feel that this blanket ban was needed versus the patchwork quilt approach?
A couple things. First of all, we are going to be one-to-one in classrooms with Chromebooks this year, so that really changed the conversation. A number of teachers in the past have wanted to have students to have access to smartphones because there are some benefits around being able to do research, access information quickly. With having Chromebooks in every classroom for every student this coming year, that really kind of takes that out of the equation. It has been difficult. The patchwork approach has been difficult for students because they have a hard time shifting from a classroom where they can, you know, use their cell phone as long as they're using it more or less responsibly and not causing an active distraction, moving from that to classrooms where they can't use them at all and aren't supposed to have them visible. You know, that kind of confusion, lack of consistency creates an understandable struggle for students in terms of knowing what it is that we expect of them.
And I imagine a struggle for teachers to say, stop looking at Instagram and pay attention to what I'm saying to you.
You know, the distraction in the classroom is really amazing, the level that it's gotten to. And society really charges us with providing the best possible learning opportunities we can for students. Our teachers take that charge very seriously, and we want to hold classroom time as sacred as possible for learning. And you know, I really think that unless you've tried it, it's very hard to imagine how hard it is to supervise 30 kids at a time, even high school age kids, in a classroom and keep them from doing things like texting under their desk or having an earbud in one ear that's turned away from the teacher listening to music. You know, we have some teachers who are fantastic with classroom behavior management who still struggle with the constant interruption that smartphones represent.
Makes me wonder, how long have you been teaching, Jeff? When did you start?
I started in education about 16 years ago.
So you've seen the introduction and then the rise, particularly the smartphone. I mean, those early cell phones, not so much. But
right.
What have you seen as far as how long did it take before they became basically attached to every kid's hand?
Well, I'll say that I need to mention that it does matter based on students' home financial situation. It's not true that all of our students have smartphones, but you'd be amazed at the percentage that do. And over time, you know, a few people have them, then more kids have them, then now it's nearly ubiquitous. And the distractions that have come along with that in the classroom, in schools in general, the problems that they have promoted, it's really a tremendous change. And, you know, I know society outside of schools is dealing with this. Everyone's trying to figure out how to make sense of and make best use of this kind of technology. But it really gets concentrated in schools because of the age of kids and because they're still learning how to manage it. I'll say that if we could sit down right now, Cindy, and design what you might imagine was the ultimate distraction machine.
Right.
Right? You've got information about your favorite sports teams. You've got a million games literally at your fingertips. You've got 10 ways to communicate with your friends. You've got all the movies and music and sports events that you'd ever want to see. You've got opportunities to bully with a worldwide audience or be bullied. That's what a cell phone is. I mean, it's like you couldn't invent a machine with more opportunities to distract kids from what we're doing in the classroom. And I'll say kids, I know adults struggle with that distraction, struggle with the feeling of being addicted to constant connectedness and constant need for information and not being able to disconnect from it.
Well, I mean, look at the fight we have to have people not be texting and Facebooking and Instagramming when they're behind the wheel of a vehicle.
Absolutely. That's true. I heard some research about the buzz of receiving a text, and a sociologist was talking about how it's like being tapped on the shoulder. And we are biologically wired to respond when we get tapped on the shoulder and look and see what's happening because it could be danger or bad news. And now we get tapped on the shoulder, you know, 100 times a day. And that is damaging to kids. You know, I'll go back to our goal in education is to help students learn as much as they can and learn to think as well as they can. And the constant distraction is numbing. You know, a related topic, there's been a lot of talk about the ability to multitask. And some people will tell you that today's students are better at multitasking than we were in the past because they have so many things they need to think about. There's a lot of research on that that shows that the idea of multitasking is really a myth, that you can't do more than one thing at a time. And if you're doing two things at a time, you're doing one, then the other, and you're not doing either one as well as you could. There's a lot of research that shows that that type of distraction and trying to multitask actually lowers people's IQs in certain situations. And we want students at their best, doing their best thinking in the classroom. That's why it's so important to us. I mean, we're pretty passionate about wanting to have a distraction-free education experience.
What has the reaction been? I mean, they're not back to class yet, are they?
No, students aren't back. We have some students in for summer school, and I've talked to a few of them about it. I'll start with the reaction from parents. There was an article in the Battle Creek Inquirer that was posted, and I read hundreds and hundreds of responses to that, some from our parents, some from other adults, members of the community, and the vast majority of them were either supportive or along the lines of, you know what, we've got to figure out something different. I mean, everyone is really struggling with this. It's not just inside schools that people are struggling with it. So I feel pretty strongly we're going to have the parent support. Students, they're upset with it. They don't like the idea. To be honest with you, I was talking to a science teacher the other day about how akin this is to an addiction for kids. You know, some of our kids almost seem like they'd rather that you cut their hand off rather than take their cell phone. So it's going to be tough for them and for some kids to be disconnected from it. We'll see exactly how much of a challenge that is. And none of this is about trying to be punitive with kids. So we're going to try to work on ways to implement this in a way that's workable for kids, in a way that can help them learn what we need them to learn about responsible use of technology and our priorities here in the school. And we'll fumble our way forward a little bit and make adjustments if we need to, but we're going to make a change one way or the other.
Jeff Bowl is principal of Lakeview High School in Battle Creek, which has just switched from the patchwork quilt approach to cell phone use to a blanket ban, none in the classroom. Jeff, thank you so much for speaking with us. It's always great to talk with you.
Thank you so much, Cindy. I appreciate the opportunity.
If you fancy yourself a lyricist, it's time to sharpen your pencil and start writing.
The University of Michigan Men's Glee Club is on the hunt. They're seeking lyrics for an original new Michigan song to be premiered next April, marking U of M's bicentennial. With us now, the Associate Director of Choirs and Professor of Conducting at the U of M School of Music, Theater, and Dance, Eugene Rogers. Welcome back to Stateside.
Good to be here. It's always a pleasure.
So marking big anniversaries and big occasions with a special song, that is really part of the tradition of all University Glee Clubs, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And the Men's Glee Club here has had a long tradition in tandem with that of commissioning new Michigan songs to add to the many that we have here at the University of Michigan. And so being that it's our bicentennial, we're very excited about this opportunity.
All right, tell us more about the contest. What kind of song is it that you're looking for?
Well, the University of Michigan, starting all the way back into really the late 1800s, began to commission songs to celebrate and honor our dear university. And so,
alma mater.
Exactly. The very first one was written in 1886 by a former Latin and English professor, Charles Mills Gailey, who was an instructor that responded to an ad. And so, like that, we are basically have a call for lyrics for anyone who's faculty, student, alumni in the community that would be interested in submitting lyrics to be set to music by Associate Professor Kristen Custer, who's a composer in the composition department that will write a song that we will premiere April as we begin our year-long celebration of the bicentennial.
Well, to get everyone in the mood, let's take a listen now to a bit of the song you were referring to, written by Charles Mills Gailey, class of 1878, Laudes Aquae
yes,
Carmina.
This is the one we opened for over 100 years.
Let's take a listen. Beautiful, beautiful. How many voices are singing that?
The Glee Club consists of around 100 auditioned men.
Beautiful. And what's the message? Because not everybody took Latin.
The message is great. It says, let all praise be to thee, our dear University of Michigan, not just for today, but for all time. And then the last part says, and if you don't believe in that, then be gone to the crows.
And then Glee Club performances end with another song, also by Gailey.
Yes.
Let's take a quick listen to The Yellow and Blue from 1886. So 130 years later, Gailey's songs are still being sung. And so I'm guessing you expect students in the 22nd century to be singing this yet-to-be-written new song commemorating the bicentennial.
Absolutely. That's the goal. You know, back in the day, they would actually have song books that students would have and sing around campus, these collection of Michigan songs. And so that's as that tradition has waned, the Glee Clubs, the Men's Glee Club, the Women's Glee Club, and the Marching Band are sort of the three main groups on campus that continue this tradition of playing and performing Michigan songs. And so we believe that this new song will continue in perpetuity with these wonderful lyrics yet to be written and the music, of course, yet to be written.
And actually, we should probably talk about the history of the Men's Glee Club on the campus at the University of Michigan and where it fits in the national history of Glee Clubs.
Well, it's really quite remarkable. We are the oldest, you know, if you will, student-sponsored organization on campus, as well as being the second oldest Glee Club in the United States, Harvard being first and Michigan being second. And it really, that tradition is one that we hold hold close to our hearts because we know it's a responsibility. Being one of the oldest and most historic, we want our pillars to be representative of tradition, camaraderie, and musical excellence. And this sort of hits on all three, the New Michigan Song, the tradition of singing these songs at every concert, the musical excellence, obviously maintaining the highest standards so that we're not just a glee club that sings school songs, but we also are a respected music organization. And then also the camaraderie, songs that allow the gentlemen to celebrate their experiences here at this great university through song and through just being together.
How does the glee setting, a glee club, differ from a choir?
Well, I think one of the biggest differences is that the word glee traditionally has meant gender choirs, if you will, that sing songs that celebrate love, life, and their dear, if you will, universities. And so sometimes it was just men coming together, singing together at the bar, if you will, singing glees, if you will, sometimes humorous, sometimes with, you know, songs of double meaning and all of that. But this glee club now, that definition has broadened to be not only men singing and women singing songs about their life and love and their respected organizations and universities, but now singing traditional concert repertoire, if you will, from premiering new concert works, opera courses, music theater, you name it, contemporary popular music, social justice pieces. So the idea of glee now has broadened to just mainly mean gender-based ensembles, if you will.
I have to ask, sorry, I can't resist. Did the Fox show Glee, did you see that bump up interest? Were kids coming in who maybe had not thought of Glee, but because they, you know, came through school, you know, watching Glee? It was a hugely popular show.
You better believe it. You know, believe it, more than anything, it allowed us to explain the historic significance of our name than it did. Of course, there were a few who auditioned and we said, I think you are misunderstanding who we are. But, you know, we accept all, the group is open to any interested student on campus, undergraduate and graduate. And so we get a wide range of levels of and types of musical interests.
Well, fascinating stuff. So how can people submit lyrics? So somebody out there thinks, all right, I can write that lyric that they'll be singing 100 years from now. What's the time frame? And
absolutely. So the submission starts September 1st. The webpage goes live, so people can go to the webpage and submit their lyrics through November 15th. A committee that will include Professor Custer, myself, and students will select the winners that will be announced December 15th, and that will be performed on our April concert in Hill Auditorium, with hopefully the lyricists as well as, obviously, Professor Custer will be there. It's a $1,500 award.
That's cool, too.
And so we hope that many will apply and submit from our community, the Michigan community. We're looking forward to receiving these submissions.
How many stanzas should the lyrics be?
We pretty much say that the lyrics must be original and new. There's not published, that have been previously published. They should be shortish. The new songs, music will be a few minutes long. And while not required, we welcome non-traditional songs or poetic forms. Writers may submit multiple song lyrics. If submitting more than one, you know, we ask that they send them separately, but it should be shortish, not too long.
Okay, there we go. Well, it's going to be fun to see what turns up, and we'll put the link on our website because it's a big long one. So go to michiganradio.org. You can go to the stateside page, and we will have the link for people there to submit their lyrics. Associate Director of Choirs, Professor of Conducting at the U of M School of Music, Theater, and Dance, Eugene Rogers. Always a pleasure to have you with
us. Thank you for having us, really. Thank you. It's really a joy.
Hello, welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, as we've been talking about, Donald Trump is in Detroit this Saturday. He'll visit the congregation of Bishop Wayne T. Jackson, and then he'll sit down for an interview to be broadcast on the Bishop's Impact Television Network. Someone who will most certainly not be tuning in to watch is writer and Detroiter Aaron Foley, who is with us now. He posted a short blog piece on blackdetroit.com, a lifestyle magazine for African Americans in and around Detroit. Aaron, why do you believe inviting Donald Trump into a black church cheapens the significance of that space?
I think it does that because historically politicians who are campaigning do, especially here in Detroit, do come to the black church to court black voters. But Donald Trump's views on black Americans have been well documented. He doesn't like us very much. You know, he's very, you know, dismissive of Black Lives Matter. He's had discrimination suits filed against him. He refers to us as, quote unquote, the blacks. Like, we're just this thing that can be tossed around like a rubber ball, you know what I mean? So it's definitely dismissive of how this process works. When you do want to, you know, listen to what black voters have to say, when you do want to listen to black issues, you do go to them in a church. That's where you'll find a lot of black voters. But to come to a church when you are already dismissive of those issues and when you already have very combative views towards the black community, and then you have a pastor who is very known for, you know, all the stereotypes that we have about megachurch pastors, you know, extravagance and flaunting and things like that. Those two things together, it's toxic. It's not right.
Now, Bishop Jackson says this televised sit-down with Mr. Trump isn't a rally. It's not an endorsement. Mr. Trump, we understand, will not be speaking during the time in the church itself. He says, the bishop says, it's a chance to get answers to questions that matter to the black community. But you say you see all of this as?
As, you know, Bishop Wayne T., he has a TV station, and he wants people to tune into his TV station. Now, granted, you know, a church would lose a certain status if they endorse a candidate. You know, that's a line that he can't cross. But at the same time, he's got a TV station. You know, this is an interview that he wants people to watch. And he wants people to see, I've got a TV station, hang around with me after this interview and keep on watching my TV station, which my ministry broadcasts on, watch my ministry, watch my church, donate to my funds, and keep it going. That's all that is. I mean, it's the same reason why anybody would put Trump on TV, because people want to see crazy. This is a train wreck, pretty much. So,
all right, let me just toss this out here, Aaron Foley. What if Mr. Trump visited with a different pastor, one of your choosing? I guess what I'm trying to ask is it the pastor or is it Mr. Trump that you're most taking issue with?
In this case, I mean, I think there's a lot of blame going around, but I think in this case it would be the pastor. And I don't think any pastor in Detroit in their right mind would sit down with Trump because of, you know, how combative and dismissive he is. But here in Detroit, you know, Google has the receipts, I guess, showing that Bishop Jackson is a very flamboyant, extravagant pastor. It's not the kind of down-home church, you know, we would think a presidential candidate would go to, but rather it's a mega church. You know, not to say that all mega churches are bad, but to many people, this falls under the category of, you know, the pastor driving a Cadillac while everybody else is poor. You know what I mean? It's just very problematic, I guess.
Aaron, what would be your thoughts if Hillary Clinton were doing the very same thing, coming to the congregation and then sitting down and meeting with Bishop Jackson?
I'm not sure what either candidate would have to offer, because in this case, Trump is sitting down with Bishop Jackson in the studio, not in the congregation, so he's only going to be talking one-on-one. It would still be a problem if Hillary did the same thing, because she wouldn't be talking to the congregation. It would just be one-on-one. I still think it would be a ratings grab, even if she were doing it. But it does call into question, like, how either party treats black voters. You know, why go to a TV station or a mega church? You know, why not get there out on the ground? You know, talk to community groups, talk to block clubs, talk to senior citizen centers and things like that. Does it always have to be the biggest, brightest, flashiest church on the block?
And you wrapped up your blog piece at blackdetroit.com urging everyone, particularly people of color, to ignore Trump in Detroit on Saturday because?
Because the last time he was here in Michigan to, quote-unquote, court black voters, he went to Diamonddale. And we all know that Diamonddale, I mean, the black population is very low there. I think this strategy is very fraught with issues. I don't think he will be saying anything that will sway us in one direction or another. I think this is all just a vanity for both him and Bishop Jackson.
Aaron Foley, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Yep, no problem.
We reached out to Bishop Jackson, but he did not respond to our request for an interview. Lansing Mayor Virge Bonaro has taken an unusual step. He's declared a housing emergency in the capital city. The declaration comes after a Southside Lansing hotel informed dozens and dozens of residents they'll be evicted in just the next few weeks. Dr. Joan Jackson-Johnson is director of Lansing's Human Relations and Community Services Department. She is with us now. Dr. Johnson, tell me, how are you feeling right now at your office with this housing crisis going on?
I feel like I'm drowning. It's a lot going on, a lot of people to place, a lot of people that shouldn't be where they are, and we're hoping that through our community partners and resources from the state, the county, the city, that we'll be able to improve the lot of life of the individuals, and particularly the children and the seniors that find themselves in a situation at the Magnuson Hotel.
Tell us, can you describe the building and the living situation for these families?
Well, the building is an older building. The inside of the building certainly leaves a lot to be desired. I'm almost embarrassed to admit this, but I spent my honeymoon there when I was a student at Michigan State in July of 1970. The number of times I've been there recently, I told my husband I had a flashback. I don't think anything has changed, including the carpet, since then. So that gives you a rough idea. There are multiple issues, heating, cooling the first floor. They have a portable air conditioner in the lobby. In my opinion, it needs to be grazed and start anew. It is not fit for anyone to live in that particular unit. And one of the challenges is we have families where there are 5, 6, 7 people in a household. I'm looking at some of the information right now. We have a 54-year-old, 48, 27, 22, 9, and a 4-year-old that's in one room with one bed. There are no cooking facilities. So this isn't housing. This is 2 steps away from being homeless on the street.
When do these people have to be out?
They need to be out on or before September the 12th, and at that time I'm told the owners will lock the building down.
What has to happen then, Dr. Johnson, between now and then?
Well, we're going to make every heroic effort that we can to assist people in finding housing, but you'll realize that one of the reasons that some people are here is poor rental history. We have some sex offenders that are there that have difficulties being lodged, but we also have Public Act 615, which is the utility program that indicates that individuals that lose gas, water, or light will have their houses red tagged. And if you have subsidized housing, such as a voucher for Section 8 or Lansing Housing Commission, it's a violation of your lease, you will lose your housing. And people, we've got about 10 families out there that fell into that situation because of utilities. So if they apply for a state of emergency assistance from Department of Health and Human Services, they will say this is not a crisis season and denied assistance with utility payment. And I'm appalled at that, because if I lose gas, water, or lights in my house, it's a crisis for me, regardless of the time of the year. So I think sometimes lawmakers don't realize that they create a worse problem, you know, for families, and then in the end, it costs us more to try to relocate folks and rehouse them when we don't provide some support and assistance.
Lansing Mayor Virge Bonaro has declared a housing emergency. Dr. Johnson, what does that let you do?
The housing emergency allows Lansing Housing Commission in particular to open up vacant units that they have and put people that find themselves in this situation, the Magnuson, they will go to the top of the list because of homeless or becoming homeless through no fault of their own. It hopefully will also allow Michigan State Housing Development Authority to filter down some additional Section 8 vouchers to the city.
The grassroots group Homeless Angels has been working with people in Lansing who need housing, and they put quite a few of these families in this very building. Has their work, in your view, helped or exacerbated the situation?
Well, I think that the heart of the Homeless Angels certainly is in the right place. Unfortunately, they weren't in a position to provide the support services that people needed to move on. We tried to work with them earlier this year. I took DHHS and a number of other human services agencies there. And, you know, we were only able to help a handful of people because the rest didn't follow through. We have identified a number of people that have been out there for 2 years. We identified a senior with a disability and an animal that's been out there almost 3 years. That's just unconscionable, in my opinion. But the Homeless Angels are not social workers, and I think they've tried to do the best that they can. They've done some fundraising. We're hoping that some of the dollars that they raise, that they'll use those to help us place individuals in housing, because coming up with that first month rent and deposit and clearing up any back utility bills will be a huge challenge. The city doesn't have the budget for that, so we're, you know, have open hands and hope that citizens and other individuals with dollars through the state or other resources will assist us. So groups like the Homeless Angels, you have to commend them for having their hearts in the right place, but, you know, they really need to be cautioned in that, is this your forte and do you need to partner with other agencies with more experience? Sometimes is the case.
I have to wonder, why do you think more people didn't leave earlier? You say you've been reaching out for months. Why do you think more people didn't leave then?
Well, because I think they thought that their histories of rental, with, you know, if you have several evictions on your record, some landlords aren't willing to assist. But in our case, when we can guarantee that rent, you know, over a period of time, that should have been the difference. In other cases, I think it's been an open-door policies where other relatives have joined them. I mean, to have some of the numbers that we have in place is just unreal for one unit. I'm looking at one where there are eight people in a room, and I asked the people at the Magnus, and they said, well, they have some double rooms. Even if it's a double room with a king bed, eight people, where are they sleeping?
This does seem like awfully abrupt notice. And the building's owner, Alvin Pei, lives in Singapore, very tough to reach, I'm told. What's his responsibility in this situation?
Well, the city is researching that to see, because we really, to say that realistically, we've identified 94 people, and that includes the children. To do this in this short time period would be almost a miracle. And so the city's exploring the resources that they have to see if there's a way that we can, in fact, you know, get some additional time.
Why do you think he's closing this building?
I think this is his way of getting rid of the homeless angels and all the homeless individuals that are there. I'm told by Mike Carl with the Homeless Angels that they wanted them to make a commitment to pay 12 to 14,000 a month for rent and then pay for all of the utility charges.
Where do you think all of these people will be by September 12th?
Our shelters are full. You cannot find a bed in any shelter. We're hoping to move people, you know, who are ready to get out of shelters and open space. But I don't know, to be totally honest with you. And to even think of moving them from one hotel to another would be a total waste of resources that we don't have. So the ideal solution would be to buy some extra time and try to move people from there into housing.
Dr. Joan Jackson-Johnson is the director of Lansing Human Relations and Community Services Department. Thank you, Dr. Johnson, for speaking with us.
Thank you.
This year brought a Detroit area TV commercial for an auto dealership that had a very unique twist.
It's the Toyota Time sales event going on now right here at Fox Toyota in Rochester Hills. Good morning and happy Saturday, Metro Detroit. I'm John Fox, here with my general manager, Rick Hodges.
And that is owner of Fox Toyota, John Fox. And next to him is Rick Hodges, the general manager of the VW and Toyota dealerships for Fox Automotive in Rochester Hills. And he is signing for hearing impaired viewers. Rick, why did you start doing that this year?
Well, you know, one thing we talk about all the time is trying to be able to reach every customer. We live in such a diverse area of different dialects, and we knew across campus wide that we have people that work for us, part of the team, that all together we can speak 16 different dialects, one of which is American Sign Language. But what we were trying to do is send out a message, and how could we send that message to let everybody know exactly what we can offer to the customer to come in so that they can buy or purchase a vehicle at their convenience and be able to understand clearly exactly what they're buying.
Well, so we see you doing the signing in the ads, doing it beautifully. How did you become so fluent in American Sign Language, Rick?
My parents were deaf, so growing up, I learned how to sign before I could speak, and it comes naturally to me. My father is unfortunately passed about 15 years ago, but my mother, who's 88, is still around, and that's how we communicate.
What kind of response have you gotten to these ads? Has it paid off?
It has. Overwhelming. It's not just from the deaf and hearing impaired community, but from everyone. People have reached out to us, thanked us, and also congratulated us for, you know, thinking outside of the box. We've had so many people actually as far out as 50 to 100 miles that have driven to our dealerships in order to purchase a vehicle because we're able to communicate with them and where they can understand all the details of buying a car. There's so much translation lost when you're trying to write notes, and so many questions go unanswered, where here they feel a lot more comfortable, and we're a lot more comfortable because we're able to disclose all the numbers, and it's just been overwhelming.
So when a customer comes in, no matter to which dealership, are you the one sitting down and doing the signing for to kind of facilitate things for them?
I am. I am contacted. My office is actually in the Toyota building, but we do have three different rooftops, Volkswagen, Toyota, and Chevrolet. In the event one of the customers show up in one of the other showrooms, they call me. They notify me. Either they'll page me or they'll call me by my cell phone. And then I make my way over there and go through the whole process with them.
And clearly, the ownership of the dealerships believe this is worthwhile because you started with Toyota and VW, but now you're running them on the Chevrolet as well.
That is correct. The wonderful thing is we do have a brand we feel that appeals to everybody, but certain people are set in buying certain brands. And we want to let them know that, yes, you have an option, not just Toyota or Volkswagen, but in this case, General Motors Chevrolet.
Now, are you aware of any other auto dealerships with this approach and using someone using American Sign Language, at least in Michigan, or are you the first to the best of your knowledge?
I believe we are the first. I have never seen it by all the phone calls and emails that I've been receiving. Everybody, they've stated that this is the first time they've ever witnessed or experienced this as well.
Rick Hodges is the general manager of VW and Toyota dealerships for Fox Automotive in Rochester Hills. Rick Hodges, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you very much, Cynthia.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors include Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, and Lindsay Scullin. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.